I was not born in India. As you heard, I was born in New York City. I just flew in from India yesterday, and tomorrow I'll be going to the USA. I'm based 4 or 5 months of the year in Australia and New Zealand. The rest of the year I travel all over. And I've been doing that for 30 years, so I get to see a global perspective on all levels. In approaching the subject matter tonight, I was wondering how cautious I should be. I'm sure all of you are aware of the basic dilemma that human society faces today. When you look at the human situation from the economic point of view, there seems to be no way out of this dilemma. Our current societies are based on never-ending economic growth. This is the London School of Business, and certainly no one's coming here to pursue their advanced studies thinking they're going to shut down growth completely. Most would want to, in some way, be a part of economic growth. The question is, how can that growth go on in a way that doesn't bring about extraordinary liabilities that you all are aware of? Number one, the planet doesn't have unlimited resources for constant economic growth, nor is there unlimited space to dispose of the waste from constant economic growth. Number two, even if there were no physical constraints to constantly increasing economic growth, even if the laws of nature didn't exist, there were no resource limitations, waste disposal limitations, and the growth tiger could ferociously roar without cessation, would that make people happy? Many of you are aware of the newfound science of happiness. It's about 10 years old in certification. And generally, the basic proposition is that beyond a basic middle class standard of living, any further increase in wealth or luxury does not lead to an increase in happiness as measured by standard psychological indicators. So, we have an interesting situation here. First of all, there's not unlimited room in nature for unlimited growth. And secondly, even if there were, people don't become any happier beyond a certain level of economic attainment. What to do? We can make very nice proposals for benign growth. And no doubt leading thinkers in the UK, the USA, and other first world countries are doing that. In the UK, you have your various forums and foundations, such as NEF, New Economic Foundation. Some of these organizations are more radical than others. Let's consider, though. It can be within our scope to tinker with the growth mechanism and make it more beneficial and benign. The problem, however, is that the population in places like the UK and the USA doesn't compare to the population in India and China. Especially, that comparison doesn't hold up in the coming decades, when, as you know, by 2050, it's projected that there'll be 9 billion people on the planet Earth. So we may tinker and adjust, but the majority of the world's population hasn't tasted what those in the first world have tasted. And so their appetite is quite hungry. So we have to look at the whole planet as a whole. What will it take to make adjustments that are significant, not simply for the first world, but for the entire world? You know better than I what the flip side of the coin is. Without constant economic growth, how do societies, as they're wired now, go on? All right, let's say, for example, just the UK. You adopt so many measures to make economic growth minimal for the sake of saving the environment, for the sake of trying to avoid busts such as in 2008. Let's say in England, you want to lead the way in doing that. But everyone will point out, how can you just pull out of the international market system? What will be the ramifications? Who will invest in this country anymore? Unemployment will soar even higher. It's like everyone's in the game worldwide, and you can't step out. So this is the flip side of the coin. On the one hand, constant growth doesn't work environmentally. On the other hand, if you stop the growth, how does society as we know it go on? If we look at daring and bold economic theories for restructuring, most of you would probably say, well, that's really not the answer. Exhortations that people should start bartering, they should start growing their own food, sewing their own clothes. Such proposals sound very pristine and idealistic, but they don't hold up according to conventional economic analysis. Such proposals can't be the answer, that we all go back to a village economy. Traditional Indian village life. Time for so much social capital, relations, family, friends, talking. Everything localized, small scale. I don't know how many of you would accept that this such a response is a practical one to the environmental and economic conundrums of today. So you would say, perhaps, these very idealistic proposals, they're not the answer. For example, at Columbia University, the famous economist Jeffrey Sachs, he says in his analysis of the USA, he's world renowned for analyzing the economic situations in third world countries, the developing world, but he turned his focus recently on the USA and said, The solution lies in Americans becoming more considerate, more cooperative, more moderate, more humble in their aspirations. Immediately, of course, it was pointed out to him, what is your economic proposal? What's your business proposal? What's your business plan for inducing such qualities? That's not my department, that was his answer. It's not my department for trying to think how people can modify their behavior so that their presence on the Earth planet becomes more benign. It has to be done, but don't look to me for the answers. Many economists are saying that what you're dealing with is actually not an economic problem, you're dealing with a moral problem. So, no answer how to modify human behavior so that human beings will live within natural environmental constraints, and also so that they will not injure themselves in pursuing greed. No answer seems to be forthcoming that's satisfactory, other than going back to small-scale village life. One could justifiably say that that's no answer. But then you have to be honest and look at the other side. Conventional economics hasn't given any answer. So what you see on both fronts is no answer. We should be fair. The small scale, small is beautiful, localize everything, village economics, most will say that's no answer. But we have to be fair and say conventional economics has no answer. Growth has to go on. Otherwise, there's massive unemployment, household income drops, and then you're back in a recession. If the growth does go on, as we know it, the Earth's environment is destroyed, and many would say people's inner character is destroyed. So what to do? On this side, no answer. On that side, no answer. What I propose is that we try to solve this difficulty by looking at something we've ignored, possibly. Let's put human beings back into the center of the issue. This is the approach of the spiritual literature of India, that first you start with the human being as a creature of desire, and then you try to understand what is the best desire for human beings to have. There have been various solutions proposed since time immemorial, since antiquity, how to deal with desire. Some spiritual paths say you should recognize you have desire and annihilate it. Stop desiring completely. I don't know if any of you ever tried to do that. Go through a weekend in which you were not going to desire anything. What the Vedic solution presents is the impossibility of annihilating desire, because desire is the symptom of the spiritual entity inhabiting the body. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes a non-sectarian challenge. Krishna presents the point that what is there about you that doesn't change, although the body is always changing? In Sanskrit, dehino smin yata dehe komanam yuvanam jara tata dehantara praptir dhiras tatra namuyati. The body is changing from babyhood, childhood, young adulthood, old age, death. Why consider that death is the last change, no more changes? Why not see that just as your basic core identity has remained the same, although your body has changed so dramatically in this lifetime, why not see death also as a portal, another change, leading to another birth? So this is Krishna's non-sectarian challenge in Bhagavad Gita, a famous spiritual classic. In other words, whether you call yourself Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, atheist, agnostic, whether you call yourself British, Russian, American, mixture, still, your body is changing. So what is it about your existence that doesn't change, although the body is changing? Nowadays, of course, it's accepted by neuroscientists that even the brain cells change. So, if we can understand the non-material identity of the self, we can easily understand then what is desire. If we see desire as the expression of the non-material self. Consumer society means how to inflame temporary material desires. How are you going to get people to want more and more and be dissatisfied with what they already have? So then you find that people become trapped in a cycle, as you know, work, buy, consume, and die. That cycle goes on even though their own habitat is being destroyed. But what can be done? It's been observed here in the UK, for example, that the only time the carbon emissions went down was during the recession. In other words, people voluntarily haven't shown an ability to do that. It's only by when there's no other option. So you can't blame people for this when they have been managed in such a way that they see as the goal of their life how to get more and more and be dissatisfied with what they have. There is so much social pressure for that. That social pressure comes in two forms. Number one, habitual patterns of consumption. Very difficult to break. These habitual patterns of consumption are ingrained so deeply. Number two, social comparison. You look around and you see someone has more. It's natural, it feels, that you also want more. You don't want to be perceived as not keeping up. In fact, you might be surprised that a few hundred years ago, the founder, the ideological founder of capitalism, Adam Smith, said that the prime motivating factor in economic affairs is the individual's desire to avoid shame. You don't want to be seen as not being able to forge ahead and demonstrate a suitable level of acquisition. Anthropologists will point out that even in primitive societies, you'll see that there is the desire to show your status. These things are known, but how to actually get your fingers on the trigger? This is why I think the ancient yoga texts are so important. They point to desire as the indestructible expression of the indestructible living entity which doesn't change, although the body is changing. So, if we look at the spiritual wisdom of ancient India, we then become familiar with desire management. A materialistic society means how to inflame the desire for the temporary. That means you want to, number one, spend money that you don't have, or money that you hope to get in the future. It's another way of saying money you don't have, or money that you borrow. Okay. Number one, you spend money that you don't have. Number two, for things that we don't need. Number three, in order to impress temporarily, to make temporary impressions. Number four, upon persons whom we're not going to be around very long. In other words, we'll like them temporarily, judging by the divorce rate in prevalent in so many parts of the world. So here you have the reality. Spend money you don't have or money you hope to make on things you don't really need in order to make temporary impressions on persons whom you'll only be around temporarily. Certainly we can do better than this. Let me quote you from the graduate study to Bhagavad Gita, known as Srimad Bhagavatam. It cuts right to the core of our theme, desire management. The Sanskrit goes, dharmasya hyapavargasya natto tayupakalpate. Our occupational duties, our work, our jobs, should be primarily for the purpose of spiritual enlightenment, not material gain. So if you're doing business, if you're in the corporate world, or whatever kind of employment you have, you're working to support a lifestyle of spiritual attainment. Material gain is the secondary purpose. Now, how does that work? In other words, you're going to work or you're in business in order to give, not to get. I was speaking about this at the Rotman School of Management, University of Toronto. So professors and students wanted a picture of how this would work. How do you go to work in order to give instead of get? The ordinary motivation in working, making business, is to get, so that my acquisition level rises and the acquisition level of those who are temporarily aligned with me rises. But just think, going to work or being in business to give yourself what? If we look at the spiritual texts of ancient India, we find that the real benefit we should want to give ourselves is spiritual development. So I go to work, I'm in business in order to provide a lifestyle of spiritual attainment for myself, my family, and as many other persons in the world as my resources allow. This is a liberating principle for approaching work and business. And automatically, one will find that your ecological footprint becomes smaller, your greed becomes practically extinct, regardless of your income level. If you have the skills to make a lot of money, or if you have the skills only to make a little money, your motivation is the same. This is what the yoga texts are pointing out. This is a universal motivation. I go to work to support a lifestyle focused on spiritual attainment for myself, for my family, and if my resources allow, for as much of the world as possible. This is working with the prime motivation of freeing oneself from material illusion and making spiritual progress. The whole Bhagavad Gita is focused on this point. Krishna explains that if we do our occupational affairs in such a way that everything is connected to the Supreme, those occupational affairs aren't ordinary. Our desire becomes transformed, whether we're billionaires or not. What is the motivation? Because the motivation is spiritual development, the way we use our resources, the way we live, will be different. So I find this a much more adept solution than simply some draconian measure of everyone back to small-scale village life. Or the other side, just let the greed monster roar. Let everything go on according to conventional economics. Obviously, things have come a long way since Adam Smith was to have said in a lecture a few hundred years ago that all you need to raise a society from the level of savagery to the highest refinement, all you need are three things: a basic justice system, a relative level of peace, and low taxes. It's all you need, and then society rises from the savage level to the level of highest culture. Obviously, today persons are understanding that a bit more than those three things is required. But how deep do we want to go into the core issue? I was thinking about that all day today in approaching this talk. Should it be the BAU approach, business as usual? Or should we recognize the predicament that human society is in? On the one hand, there has to be growth. On the other hand, if there's growth, what to do about the environment? If you stop growth, you're going to have a radically different human civilization. If you let growth go on, even if it's ameliorated, even if it's tinkered with in places like the UK and the USA, you've got the multitudes in India and China who have something else on their mind. What to do? I think that now more than ever is a good time to look at the ancient wisdom and how we can apply it. Once we know how to deal with our desires, that's when management begins. Am I simply the body? Or is there something more to me than just the body? In other words, we have to put the science of the self in the business curriculum. What am I? The business people should take responsibility for encouraging society in understanding the real identity of the human being. Are human beings simply the body? Is the self simply the brain? Is consciousness simply a material emanation from the brain. There are no answers today verifying that the self is simply a material imagination or a material creation of the brain. Still, we're at a complete position of mystery in regard to the identity of what is the self. This knowledge of what is the self should form a solid part of economics, because economics is about dealing with desires. So what is it that's doing the desiring? We need to know what are superior desires and what are inferior desires. I was just reading the other day a statement by one of your radical economists in the UK, Tim Jackson, who said that actually the environmental problem is a marketing problem. I thought that was a very interesting way of looking at things, because marketing deals with desires. How do we manage human desire so that human beings don't destroy themselves? And much better than that, of course, is how to manage human desires so that human beings can be all they're meant to be, to attain the highest level. So what is that highest level? To answer those questions, I became fascinated with the voluminous ancient wisdom of India, particularly in the Krishna texts like Bhagavad Gita, its graduate study, Srimad Bhagavatam. I wanted to understand what knowledge exists in terms of identifying what is the self, and more importantly, what are the laboratory procedures for verifying that knowledge of the self? Because I felt that once we understand what is the self and we can have a procedure for verifying that knowledge, not just accepting on blind faith, but verifying it through lifestyle, then we can actually deal with desire. Desire is the engine of the extraordinary problems the world faces today. But that same desire can be the greatest elevating dynamic. So what I am proposing is a different way to deal with the growth or no growth problem. Either of the two has no solution. Growth can't go on the way it has been. We're already living as if we're on more than one planet Earth. Statistically, it's been calculated we're about we're at the level of about 1.6 planet Earths, and we're heading for 2. So things can't go on in the same way. But on the other hand, what is the solution? If we stop the growth tiger, taking into account that the developing world wants to imitate the traditional levels of Western consumption, if you just slam the brakes, or even if we slow it down, society as we know it can't go on. There's massive economic failure, massive unemployment. So what to do? Population is soaring to 9 billion. Resources are becoming scarce. I think it would be fair to say that neither side, the growth or the no growth people, they don't have a solution. So I think that it's a very good time to look for ancient approaches to the situation. Recognizing there's such a thing as material desire, and there's also such a thing as non-material desire. You can't shut down the desire factory. You can't tell persons, for example, no money making, no business. There's always going to be a section of the human population that has the business propensity. It's always going to be there. The Soviets tried to deny that. I spent, by the way, 8 years underground organizing during the communist days in Eastern Europe, teaching Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam underground in communist countries. So I saw the futility firsthand of the attempt to deny that there's a mercantile section of society with a section of society with business abilities. It's completely ludicrous. So you'd be surprised that in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna recognizes that there'll always be a business class. Always. So therefore, since there'll always be a business class, how do you get the business class to do business in a way that elevates both the individual business person, and society? Just like your body has a stomach. The stomach accepts food and assimilates the nutrients, and in that way the whole body becomes energized. This is what Srimad Bhagavatam, the advanced study to Bhagavad Gita, gives as a metaphor for the business class. The business segment of society is what energizes the whole society in terms of material support. Just as you can't rip out your stomach, similarly you can't rip out the business class. You can't shut it down. So, better it is that the business class, the entrepreneurial class, acts according to its propensities in such a way that human society benefits. So back to the principle of occupation for the sake of spiritual elevation. Going to work, being in business for the sake of giving, not getting. What a liberating motivation. I'm making my business, I'm doing my corporate affairs in order to give myself the highest type of existence, to give that to my family, and if my resources allow, to give it to as many others in the world as possible. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna will explain that who enjoys the fruits of any enterprise, that is the issue. You cannot stop people from producing fruits. You can't shut down the business sector of society. But what about the fruits? In other words, what's the motivation? If everything is just to get for me, that's such a debilitating, unsatisfying, miserable motivation. And we've seen through psychological studies that people actually aren't satisfied being selfish and greedy. The more people live in an expansive way, the heart expands by giving, the happier they are. What is the best thing to give to? In order to answer that question, we need to understand what is actually the self. And we should be open to consider non-material understandings of the self. There's absolutely no proof that consciousness arises mysteriously from the brain. This is a theory. This is a religious belief. There's no proof that the brain can be understood just as a computer can be understood. There's no proof that the self is just an imagination, some other produced by the neural activity in the brain. These are all beliefs. And there is no way to verify those beliefs. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna presents that the self is an indestructible unit of spiritual consciousness that changes from one body to the other. Just as you have gone from boyhood, girlhood, to teenage years, to adulthood, and you live a full life, old age, and death. So those are various portals to pass through. So if we can understand our spiritual desires, which are more important than our temporary material desires, then we can actually have a society that's prosperous and an individual life that's prosperous. So again, I'm proposing that both sides of the argument, the growth people don't have a solution. The no-growth people don't have a solution. We have to recognize that there is desire and then focus on how to manage that desire in the most uplifting way. Just like I was explaining, there is a business section of society. You can't shut down business. It'll always go on, one way or the other. Some profit will be made. So how then can everyone in society, regardless of their occupation, work in such a way that they uplift themselves and uplift others? In order to do that, we need to recognize what is the best desire, how to manage our desires so that the temporary demands of the body and mind don't overwhelm our indestructible spiritual desires. This is the kind of knowledge that Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita, and I very happily recommend it to you all, because we are ordinarily stuck. The growth can't go on. The growth can't stop. What to do? Albert Einstein once said that a problem is never solved on its own level. So I presented something that takes things to another level. Thank you very much.